Pauline Hanson knows how to light up the switchboard of talkback radio or go viral on Twitter and Facebook. But is the One Nation leader's latest stunt, wearing a burqa into Parliament, the start of a serious debate? You'll also hear from the authors of two controversial essays. One says the grievances of the comfortable middle class are drowning out the pain of Australia's underclass. The other asks if the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse has become a hatchet job on the Catholic Church. So it's a provocative edition of the Religion and Ethics Report this week. I'm Andrew West. Forgive the croaky voice, but welcome to the program. A figure clad in black from head to toe, her face completely covered, strode into the Senate chamber last week. One member was even heard to gasp, "What on earth?" For 20 minutes, she sat there until she got the call to ask a question. And then, with theatrical flourish, she tore off the veil to reveal what everyone knew. One Nation leader Pauline Hanson wanted to ask if the government would ban the burqa, which is worn by some Muslim women. Attorney General George Brandis got a standing ovation from his Labor and Green opponents when he criticised Senator Hanson. But did he get it wrong? Professor Elham Manir from the University of Zurich has been a Swiss government commissioner, and she's the author of Women and Sharia Law.
Well, I understand that this stunt is not meant to defend women's rights. It's very important that we don't lose the bigger picture just because we don't like the political ideas of her political parties. The big picture tells us that the burqa is a symbol of something bigger, and it has to do with totalitarian ideology, and one that doesn't only suppress women, it does as well spread a certain ideology that is not only anti-democratic, it's anti-human.
Yeah. Does the burqa actually represent Islam, therefore? Because the liberal response, small L liberal, and in Australia's case, large L liberal, seem to go into overdrive to suggest that by criticising the burqa, people were criticising Islam. Does that seem right?
I was amazed when I read that, when I actually also heard the type of discussion that took place. First of all, the burqa is not Islamic. It's a tradition that comes from the heart of Saudi Arabia for a region called Najd. Only in Najd you had this type of dressing, the one that covers the whole face. In fact, if you look closer, you will see the tradition also in very tribal societies in Najd does not even allow the woman to show her face to her own sons. Mm. And some journalists in Saudi Arabia talk about that openly. The burqa, as a tradition, was not spread in areas in Saudi Arabia, in the west or in the east or in the south of Saudi Arabia, regions that are different culturally from Najd. However, since 1979, since the re-Islamization of Saudi Arabia according to the Wahhabi Salafi fundamentalist principles, that led to the mainstreaming of this burqa, and with the Gulf money, you had a kind of like a promotion of this ideology and with this reading of Islam that turned burqa into an Islamic tradition. To tell me today in Australia that by talking about the burqa we are hurting the feelings of Muslims is not only inaccurate, with all due respect, it's almost racist that you come to tell me that Muslims mainly covering their whole body.
From reading your work and the work of another distinguished Muslim academic, Karima Banoon, it is not even required of a pious Muslim woman to cover her head, strictly speaking, is it?
I agree with you. That's another problematic issue that we seem to avoid talking about because of our a certain kind of sensitivities that are becoming very weird. From my perspective, from Karima Banoon's perspective, from many other, whether academics or intellectuals in the Arab and Islamic worlds, you will see we all argue this is a symbol of political Islam. it started to become mainstreams in the 70s. Today, everybody realized that even the idea of covering your head, it started with Hassan al-Banna. I showed that in many writings. Mm. The founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, he's the one who insisted on using that as a symbol for their political ideology. One has only to read what they say about the importance of headscarf in order to mainstream their own political ideology, an ideology of domination. And at the same time, many women who are wearing the headscarf today, they're doing that because of many reasons. Some of them actually believe in the religious argument. So the problem is that we have a machinery that made this symbol Islamic.
So, Elham, what do you make of statements by our Attorney General, Senator George Brandis, and by the leader of the Labour Party in the Senate? Senator Brandis said that the burqa was an important symbol of Islam as a, quote, religious garment. Senator Wong described wearing the burqa as a sincere act of faith.
Well, that's the problem. I would say it's a naive statement, with all due respect. I would urge them to not look at the issue from where they are standing, where they think choice is a factor here, but to look at it from the culture that produced it, a culture that treats women as a sexualized object that has to be covered, that does not only deny her basic rights as a human being, but tells her that in order for you to go to heaven, you almost have to be a slave to your own husband. You have to read the literature of these Salafis, what they're telling the women. So what I will be basically saying, this is, it's almost a racist kind of like perception to think that all Muslims wants to wear the burqa, or that all Muslims, in order for them to be religious, they have to cover themselves from head to toe.
Yeah. I should point out, as well as being a professor in the Political Science Institute at the University of Zurich and author of Women and Sharia Law, Elham is also an official advisor to the government of Switzerland, and she's also been a consultant to many human rights organisations. We hear a lot about the possibility that women who wear the burqa and the niqab may be coerced. But let's put aside that question of coercion. If one chooses to wear the burqa and the niqab, what statement are they making?
They are telling us that they have entered into a sect. That's the statement that I will tell you. Basically, that we are part of a Salafi movement, and the Salafi Islam is telling me that in order for me to be a good woman, I have to cease to exist as a human being in the outside. But at the same time, I would tell you, those who join such sects in the beginning, they are almost brainwashed into believing that by doing that, they are fulfilling God's demands. Once they are in, they find themselves in a vicious circle where they are unable to leave, because suddenly they are tied by a network that does not allow them either to think or to leave. And then the oppression starts. And many of these women, and you have several cases, they enter and they realize that they made a big mistake, but they cannot get out. Yeah. And a cycle of violence, by the way, starts as well, given the fact that the Salafi Islam also condones violence against women and domestic violence under the banner that a husband has the right to discipline his wife physically. Mm. So we always have to look at the general picture when it comes to this ideology. What does it say? And it's not only about women when we talk about the burqa. It's also, what does it say about the whole society? It leads to segregation. It preaches a message of hatred. You only have to see the teenagers. They say you have to hate the others who do not believe in our way, whether Muslims or non-Muslims. We have to hate them in our heart and in our actions. It's called a principle called al-wala wal-bara'a. So we're talking about a totalitarian ideology seeking domination, and the symbol for that Is this worker?
Yeah. Well, just as we wind up, Elham, reflecting on what you've just said, if you are enthusiastic for the burqa or the niqab, what does that also say about your attitude to a society that's pluralist in a religious sense, that believes in the freedom of all religions?
Well, it gives exactly the antithesis to that. It's a sign of segregation, separation, rejection. Rejection to the values that we see all around us, values of tolerance and acceptance of otherness. That's the problem from my perspective of this symbol, because the burqa, while it tells women they have to disappear, to cease to exist as a human being, they also tell them that those around them, the whole society, they are living in jahiliya, in a time of ignorance. And all of those who are living in the time of ignorance, they are unbelievers. And they deserve to be not only actively opposed, I'll put it this way.
Yeah.
And this is one way of showing that.
Yeah. I wonder if Western liberals have come to fetishize Muslim women who cover their heads, so that Muslim women like yourself, like Karima Banoon, in fact, like the majority of the world's Muslim population until recently, who don't cover themselves, they're seen as not authentically Muslim. Have we fetishized the covering of the head?
Yes, I said that in my book, Women in Sharia Law. It's an essentialist kind of perception to Muslims. They believe a Muslim essentially has certain kind of like tenets that are unchangeable. They can't believe that a Muslim, for instance, is a person with different identities, with different attitudes. He can be or she can be liberal, conservative. No, a Muslim is religious, and religion means covering your head. If you don't cover your head, then you're not authentic. And the problem with such perception, it's not only an essentialist perception, it's inherently racist, because they, exactly like far-right groups who believe that a Muslim, every Muslim is a potential terrorist, they come on the other side and say every Muslim is religious and therefore we have to support these poor people who need our protection, never looking at these poor people as equal to them, in fact, because as an equal, you have to respect the fact that this person can be whatever this person wants.
And just finally, Ilham, you're working on a new book on nonviolent Islamism. We hear a lot about violent Islamism. In fact, we can't avoid it, the events this past few days in Spain. But what do you see as the challenge of nonviolent Islamism?
Well, the problem is that, from my perspective, just focusing on the violent side of it does not solve the problem, because the religious and ideological roots are the main roots that pave the ground for this violence. And if we just ignore the nonviolent form, which unfortunately has been mainstream as moderate Islam, we are not only complicating the problem, we are festering it. And I'm saying that right now in the book. ISIS is not my concern. We will defeat it militarily, no problem about that. But the religious and ideological roots of this violence is still mainstreamed as moderate, and that can lead to segregation of many communities living in European and North American and Australian context.
Elham Mania is a professor in the Political Science Institute at the University of Zurich. She's been a consultant to the government of Switzerland, also to NGOs and European organisations. Her latest book is Women and Sharia Law. Professor Elham Mania, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your invitation.
Professor Elham Mania from the University of Zurich and author of Women and Sharia Law. If you go to the Religion and Ethics Report homepage or subscribe to the podcast, you'll hear a longer version of that interview. This week, the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse brought down its report on the suffering of teenagers in the armed services. If you hadn't heard that the Royal Commission was also scrutinising the military, sporting and cultural groups, then could our next guest have a point? Surveys show most Australians think the Commission is just an inquiry into the Catholic Church. But in the Weekend Australian, the Vice-Chancellor of the Australian Catholic University, Greg Craven, took the Commission and the media, including the ABC, to task for their treatment of the Church. Greg Craven is also a prominent jurist. He was Victoria's Crown Counsel, and I spoke with him earlier.
Royal commissions are problematic beasts at the best of times. Royal commissions can be not terribly good at coming up with policy, and they can recruit a judicial type of atmosphere to give credibility to what, after all, is an administrative process. I think this Royal Commission falls to be critiqued like any other Royal Commission, like that into trade unions, and I don't think it's done a particularly good job in a range of areas. Some areas I think it's done a good job, but I think these are things we've got to talk about rather than having a hushed, reverential silence.
But when you talk to victims' rights groups and survivors' groups, they do talk about the value of this Royal Commission in raising the profile, not simply of their own pain and suffering, but of a crisis across all institutions, not just the Catholic Church.
And I think there certainly is value in that. And yeah, as a Catholic who obviously knows a great many victims very close to me, I can see that. But saying that one thing has been important and it's done well doesn't justify any number of mistakes that are made along the way. And that's, I think, the reality that we've got to do. The main point of that article was to say, look, we're in a position as a church where we have to accept and we have to absolutely buy into the good ideas. But that doesn't mean that we should accept that everything the Royal Commission says and does is correct. There is a danger with this type of subject matter that we will say, well, therefore, everything it does is right. That doesn't work for anyone.
You wrote that there was an adoring media that had treated the chair of the Royal Commission, Justice Peter McClellan, and the counsel assisting, Gail Furness, who once worked for you, I think, when you were the Solicitor General in Victoria, as, quote, folk heroes. And you suggest that their performance should have been more closely scrutinised. Why did they need more scrutiny, in your view?
Well, I would say Gail actually worked for me when I was running a parliamentary committee. But every Royal Commission needs scrutiny. I mean, you and I will remember that Royal Commissions have coercive powers. They have the ability to use those powers well or badly. When we had a Royal Commission effectively into trade unions, that was scrutinised relentlessly by political opponents, by the ABC, by Fairfax. You might remember that Dyson Heydon, the Royal Commissioner, was pilloried for having accepted an invitation to give a talk, I think before he was a Royal Commissioner, to some group distantly connected to conservatives. All Royal Commissions should be critiqued. And I think what has happened is there has been a suspension of that normal critique because of the subject matter of this Royal Commission. Now, that's not healthy. It's not healthy in the media. It's not healthy in democracy. And it's not healthy in genuine civilised debate. Mm.
But, Greg, what is there, in a sense, to scrutinise? Because I don't think anyone's doubting the welter of figures. And, again, I emphasise this is a Royal Commission not just into the Catholic or even only the churches, but just that data on the Catholic Church alone was pretty overwhelming. 4,444 people who'd made or lodged sexual abuse claims against the Church between 1980 and 2015. I mean, what's there to scrutinise or question about that?
Where does one start? I mean, there are two sets of things you can scrutinise any Royal Commission. One is its process, one is its recommendations. Now, in terms of process, as I said in the article, I have conducted more public inquiries than I can remember. I can tell you now that if you run a public inquiry with a particular focus on a particular aspect of the inquiry, in this case, the Catholic Church, of course you'll miss all sorts of important things. Now, the Royal Commission's own figures, as I understand it, tells us that most people think this is a Royal Commission into the Catholic Church. That's not surprising, because I think that's pretty much how it's been conducted. Now, there are endless numbers of abuse. Forget families. You know, think of state governments. Think of all sorts of things that really haven't come up in any sort of major way in this Royal Commission. Now, my own view is that we're going to end up having a series of inquiries after this Royal Commission. Now, of course, the argument back to that is you're a Catholic, you would say that, wouldn't you? Well, frankly, I think that every victim is entitled to have their case inquired into with the same type of seriousness. And I think this Royal Commission has, in that sense, conducted a flawed inquiry.
Your major concern last week leading up to the essay was the Commission's recommendation that the law require Catholic priests to report to police on cases of sexual abuse they hear about in confession. But stepping back, Greg, mandatory reporting looks to most people both common sense and morally correct, doesn't it?
Well, I think that's the position that's tried to be put forward. But I think what you've got to think about this is you've got to not simply look at it from one point of view, and you've got to look at it from the point of view of fundamental religious freedom. Now, the fact is that you can't be a Catholic priest unless you are bound by the seal of a confessional. Otherwise, you're automatically excommunicated. You cannot be a Catholic in full communion unless you go to a confessional ministered by a priest bound by the seal of confession. It effectively makes it impossible to be a fully practicing Catholic. Now, that's big. That is, in fact, the biggest attack, if it were implemented, on freedom of religion in the history of this country. Now, the thing that I've been thinking about is, what would the equivalent be in another context? So let me hit you with this one. What would happen if you had a royal commission into God knows what that said, we've had a little bit of a look at the Holy Quran, and we think that there are certain texts in that that encourage jihad. And that's a really bad thing, because people get killed with that. So we're going to make a law that prohibits the printing or reading of those verses in the Quran in Australia. Now, you would rightly tell me this was an atrocious breach of civil liberties. Why doesn't the same type of critique apply here?
Just as we wind up, you're a member of the Truth, Justice and Healing Council. On last week's program, the deputy chair of that council, Elizabeth Proust, expressed grave fears, not so much that the abuse would return, but what she says is the structures and the culture of the church of keeping problems in-house, of control by an all-male circle of archbishops. She fears this won't change. What, as a fellow member of that council, do you make of her critique?
Look, I have huge respect and fondness for Elizabeth. I think she's wrong. I think one of the really good things with the Royal Commission is that it makes it virtually impossible for the church to believe and not to face realities. And all the evidence I see is that the church is indeed facing those realities. I mean, look at the fundamental issue of redress. The Catholic Church is pretty much the only big organisation that's already signed up to that. So I'm afraid I'm much more hopeful than Elizabeth on that point.
Australian Catholic University Vice-Chancellor Greg Craven, and there's a link to his essay at our website. You're with Andrew West. Who speaks for the working class, especially when unions are weaker, corporations powerful, and the educated middle class preoccupied with the politics of culture, gender and sex? And by ignoring working class pain, has the political left handed their votes to politicians like Donald Trump? Writer Shannon Burns got his hands dirty and calloused in many a tough job before joining the progressive middle class. He's now a fellow at the J.M. Coetzee Centre at the University of Adelaide. Shannon Burns' essay, In Defence of the Bad White Working Class, appears in the current edition of Meanjin.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing. Actually, I was born into what I call the lumpen proletariat in the essay. So the underclass, really, sort of underemployed, petty criminals. And I sort of gradually worked my way up. I left school at 15 and took on a labouring job, unskilled labouring. So I was a lower working class boy and young man up until in my early 20s I finally went to university. So the thing that I've found is that I have these three voices in my head all the time, and I kind of switch them on and off here and there. But I have noticed in recent times that the lower class voice and the working class voice have been piping up a bit in response to some of the ways of approaching social issues that my progressive friends and colleagues have decided to employ.
Yeah. One way, of course, that these working class voices have been piping up is through Donald Trump. You're not a Trump supporter. You don't embrace that ideology. How does society stop the Donald Trumps of this world trading on legitimate working class angst?
Well, I guess the obvious thing would be to make an attempt to first understand and then appeal to sections of the community that Donald Trump is either appealing to or not angering. So I think that in something like the US, you have a different political system. You know, people can be disenchanted and simply not vote. So I think that if you don't have candidates who appeal to the working class or the white lower class, often they just won't come out for you. I think that's probably been the case. And I think that Donald Trump represents a kind of rubbing a progressive's nose in their own muck to a degree. There's been a feeling that they've been neglected, that no one is making a sincere appeal to them and to their concerns, and so they're reasonably happy to welcome a phase of Donald Trump that'll at least kind of get under the skin of the rest of the country, the rest of the world.
Yeah, as I said, you have no sympathy for Trump and his ideology, but you understand the dynamic. There's a brilliant piece here where you say, I confess that if a well-dressed, university-educated, middle-class person of any gender or ethnicity so much as hinted at my, quote, white privilege while I was a lumpen child, or my male privilege while I was an unskilled labourer who couldn't afford basic necessities, or my hetero privilege when I was a homeless solitary, I'd have taken special pleasure in voting for their worst nightmare. I get what you're saying here. Is voting for someone's worst nightmare a legitimate expression, or can it be self-defeating?
Well, it can be both. Legitimate expression and self-defeating can go hand in hand. What it is it's a temptation. And while that temptation is available and there's no other obvious affirmative prospect, then sometimes you'll take that destructive step. One of the interesting things about when I was growing up and figuring these social issues out for myself is that no one was making those claims about me. So I fairly comfortably slotted into, or, you know, came to embrace progressive ideas, because no one was talking about my white privilege. No one was really talking about my hetero privilege at that time. So, you know, in the 1990s, probably. You know, I didn't have that accusation levelled at me as I was trying to figure out where I stood politically. I think that that was an important part of my own political development.
Interesting, because Barack Obama, himself the beneficiary of, you know, a middle-class progressive wave that swept America, made the point that he understood that when a college-educated person of colour at Harvard University started talking to lower-class people about their privilege, regardless of their own race, he knew that that would cause angst across the country.
Yeah, well, Obama was, among other things, he was very aware of how rhetoric works. I mean, rhetoric has something to do with your positioning, your social positioning, as well as the way that you speak to people and the way that you try to persuade or inspire them. So as someone who is aware of those factors, I think that it's not surprising that Obama was good at appealing to the white working class. At least he didn't lose ground in the same way that other progressives did. He had a story to tell them. He had a way of addressing them that often was surprisingly successful. The fact that someone called Barack Obama, who was a, you know, mixed-raced man, became the President of the United States twice, I think has a lot to do with a kind of rhetorical mastery.
You're right. As a consequence, middle-class grievances now drown out lower-class pain. First of all, what's the lower-class pain that's being overwhelmed in the public sphere by the middle-class grievance?
There are lots of different kinds of lower-class pain. I mean, one of them has to do with employment, types of employment, the precarity of employment. Another has to do with the forms of education that are available to lower-class people. Often they're of a much lower standard just because of some of the conditions of education. There's a lot of behavioural control going on in schools in low socioeconomic environments. The pains of coming to grips with the fact that the world around you is slowly dissolving because that working class world is being sent offshore. That the culture, and I do think of working class cultures as distinct cultures, is being erased to some degree, and you have to figure out a way of moving into another kind of cultural context. And then there is just the harshness of life that often accompanies lower class background. So there are forms of violence.
Yeah, well, you paint this very vividly, and I want you to tell us about it, because you've got very little time, and I've got to say, understandably so, for people who talk about words that feel violent to the progressive upper middle class versus what you experienced. What did you experience?
Well, especially as a young man, as a child, there was a great deal of domestic violence around. Kids were hit a lot. Every kid that I hung out with was hit a lot. And we all had fights in the streets and at school. There was always the threat of violence from various groups within the world that I grew up in. So I talk in particular about a place called Mansfield Park, which is where I spent some years, which underwent a transition as a result of a wave of migration. So it began as a kind of Eastern European migrant settlement in a way, and then things shifted over time, and particularly Vietnamese, Chinese, Cambodian migrants came in. And there was white crime to begin with, and that sort of shifted over to principally, I think, Vietnamese gangs. There were things like, you know, knives used in my primary school. There was just a general sense of a different kind of violence that was happening there.
Yeah, but violence, Shannon, in your own home, that was the
the
really powerful point. What happened there?
Well, everyone was violent when I was a kid. My parents had very tough upbringings. They came from very lower class backgrounds. They, I'm sure, were beaten a lot. I didn't know it at the time, but I suspect now there was some hidden mental illness about it. So people just reacted violently. So you were always wary of being hit, and you were always witnessing other people being hit.
Yeah. Not quite the Mansfield Park, the bucolic Mansfield Park of Jane Austen.
No, there's a lovely irony about that. It was a strange experience to come to Jane Austen after living in my Mansfield Park.
Yeah. Under the rules that the upper middle class progressives have set, you say that if you wanted to, you could wallow in the sense of exclusion of being not making a shortlist for a literary award, and you could suggest that that was part of a sort of structural violence if you applied what you say are the rules of the progressive upper middle class.
Yeah, I make a distinction there between what I think is a fairly benign kind of discrimination against what I think of as very material forms of violence which require urgent attention. I think that they get conflated a little bit. Sometimes it just has to do with the rhetoric that progressives use, and they want to talk about the violence of some group being left out of an awards shortlist or something along those lines. I'm not sympathetic to that rhetorical move because I have some experience with violence.
Yeah.
I suppose the point was just to emphasise that when some groups of people talk about violence, they have one thing in mind, and when other people talk about violence, they have quite another thing in mind.
Just finally, Shannon, despite the provocative title In Defence of the Bad White Working Class, the impression that I get is that you are seeking a politics that's actually quite unitary, that's based on uniting around a more sort of common social justice economic goal rather than seeking to divide based on identity. Am I right there?
Yes, although I'm really writing from the voice of the working class and the lower class perspective there. And I think that what I'm showing is that their position is legitimate when you take into account their experiences.
Mm.
But they're also legitimate middle class experiences. What I would say is that the middle class has a duty to sell those concerns that they have in a more persuasive, less grating manner than they typically do. And they need to just demonstrate some awareness that their primary ethical concerns are the result of where they come from, and to think about how to bridge the gaps between themselves and other social groups.
Yeah, more than a duty, though, to sell, you make a very good point here. Middle-class progressives have no qualms about exercising their natural right to determine the moral values of the world. A fairer approach would surely entail sacrificing one's own comfort for the cause.
Yes. I mean, I think that much of lower-class racism has something to do with the fact that there are these impositions experienced that middle-class people don't experience. So in the article, I talk about the fact that, first of all, lower-class people don't typically have the opportunities to experience other cultures on their own terms. Mm. Instead, those cultures are brought to them. They live among them. And so there's a more kind of confronting experience with that. Some people manage that well and others don't. I think also that when it comes to migration, those of us who would say that offshore detention is a horror aren't all that good at proposing a way of embracing migration that won't be so alienating to people who typically have to live with it. So I would say that middle-class people don't have to deal with a competition around employment because they're working in professions where people will, if they're migrants, will have to be retrained or they might not have the education to begin with. I say that unskilled labourers certainly have to deal with competition for employment. While I was writing this article, we had a problem with our hot water. An electrician came out and he was talking about this nursing home that he has been working for a long time, and he was saying that the cleaners who had been there for 20 years had now just recently been sacked and a new kind of contract company had taken over, and implicitly, well, actually rather explicitly, he was saying that they were migrant workers. So there were this unskilled labour, migrant workers directly seeming to take the jobs of unskilled lower class whites. And that's a problem. That's a problem that we don't experience in the middle class.
Yeah. And the benefits always flow ultimately to the upper class in that circumstance, or to the owners of the business.
Yes, the benefits flow. And even when it comes to middle class migration, the benefits flow to us as well, because it is a deeply enriching experience for us to have people from other cultures in our lives who are non-threatening.
Great to talk to you. Dr. Shannon Burns is an Adelaide writer and critic. He's with the J.M. Coetzee Centre at the University of Adelaide. Shannon, thanks for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks for having me on.
Shannon Burns of the J.M. Coetzee Centre. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a rating. Thanks to Nadia El-Ghouli and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.